Okay, questions? Okay, I'm holding the discussion section at 3:30 for beta carotene, 4:30 for the audiology. I will be trying to record it. There will be some part of that will be useful for. There will be some part of it that will be less useful for, just as people ask questions. You won't hear that, but there are some parts that are more prepared that I will have recorded. I do want the statistical analysis plans. I just did decide to hold the line. The reason why the email came out about, you know, make certain you name your files correctly, and why I'm being such a jerk about it on this one is because even though I don't have a time limit on this one, I have found that the ability of people to ever follow directions, myself included, is at best about 90%. But really, on the later things, if the files are named wrong, I mess up sending it out to the other groups. So I really need you to look at the instructions for the project. Look how the files have to be named, because I then rely on them being named correctly as I try to send them out. I'm not sending out the statistical analysis plan to anybody else. I'm just being a jerk about that, the preparation for when it really matters, when being a jerk really matters. Okay, so other questions? Okay, so we are talking about this concept as I'm looking at what I regard as the less important measures of association based on location. But I do want to cover them a little bit, and we're talking about, well, how do you choose these, and why is it so important to make a decision? Why is it so terrible of the protocols that I see that say, well, we're going to analyze the mean unless we look at the data and it doesn't look normal, and then we're going to use this test, this test, or this test. And the idea is that if you don't pre-specify your analyses, you can go real wrong. The idea is that confirmatory studies are necessary, that you need to have a difference. Now, early phase studies are often exploratory. But as a general rule, we still try to have some things pre-specified. I got a call early this morning from my daughter, who is busy looking at malaria, and with the recent vaccine trial that they released the early results on. She goes, is this okay? And we sat and discussed for a while of saying, you know, my answer is it's okay if they pre-specified they were going to do it, and if not, they've got some explaining to do. There are situations that, you know, you just didn't think of, but you should try to think of them. Well, what are some real-life examples of this? Well, the idea that patients who have arrhythmias after an MI as seen in observational studies, it's logical to try preventing those arrhythmias. But actually, it turned out that two methods of preventing those arrhythmias, they showed this in clinical trials. They pre-specified, we will look to see whether we decrease arrhythmias. Unfortunately, they did not pre-specify, and we'll see that patients survived better because of that, and then took a later clinical trial that showed that we were actually killing people, although preventing arrhythmias. And then the beta carotene on lung cancer and survival. High dietary beta carotene, lower cancer incidence, longer survival. The CARET study and another study conducted in Scandinavia at about the same time showed that the beta carotene supplementation in smokers leads to higher lung cancer incidence and lower survival. And of course, hormone therapy, where all the observational studies, I mean, I'm the most skeptical of all people, and when I was working on this early on, even I was worried that the major problem with this trial, where the primary interest was actually seeing whether hormone therapy caused cancer, and my biggest fear at the time was trying to convince people, and if we find out that it's beneficial enough on cardiac arrest, we don't care what it does to cancer. Because a 60-year-old woman who is diagnosed with cancer has a median life expectancy of 13 years, whereas a 60-year-old woman who has a heart attack has a median life expectancy of 4 years. You know, and so that was my major concern. And so when, in fact, WHI showed higher cardiac mortality, the thing that we were all presuming it was going to be beneficial on, it came as a big shock. Now, I'll note, in each one of these cases, I used very careful wording. Please note that wording. They were different questions. It was the logical thing to do. based on the observational studies of a high risk for death from arrhythmias, it's logical to try to prevent it. But that doesn't mean that every method of preventing arrhythmias will be beneficial. And it's possible that no method of preventing arrhythmias will be beneficial. It could be that that's just a marker. You got to do something just before you die. Maybe have an arrhythmia is one of them, you know, and that it's too late at that point. Same with the beta carotene. High dietary beta carotene has lower cancer incidence. But we then gave supplementation. One of the things that might be true is you don't get high dietary beta carotene by eating a extremely carnivorous diet. Okay, but with supplementation, I can keep doing that. You know, this concept of, is this merely a sign that the vegetarian diet was what was good, and it wasn't beta carotene specifically? Of course, my brother, when asked about, you know, was he going to be a vegetarian, he said absolutely not, that the only thing he had accomplished in life was being at the top of the food chain, and hell if he was going to give that up. So, you know, it's this concept that you put him on that, and there's no chance that it would do that. And then the other thing is, it's in smokers. And again, maybe it's too late. Maybe the thing that you're potentiating at that point, there's a difference between preventing something and then once they already have it, you might be potentiating the identification of it. And of course, in hormone therapy, the observational studies took women who were taking hormone therapy. Usually, they started for control of menopausal symptoms. Many of them kept on because of the observational studies that showed good cardiac mortality. But in WHI, they were so afraid that they would not get women who were taking hormone therapy to stop taking it due to the menopausal symptoms that they didn't enroll anybody like that. You know, the eligibility criteria was, yeah, you couldn't have been on this because you have to be willing to not be on hormone therapy. So what happened, and my sister, who's OBGYN, was most irate when, you know, she woke up one day and read in the paper, gee, NCI is recommending, you know, don't anybody take hormone therapy, or NHLBI was actually in charge of the trial, but hormone therapy. And, you know, she had every one of her patients calling up and saying, am I going to die tomorrow? You know, but the key thing she said is they were taking 70-year-old women and starting them again on hormones. Isn't that different than maintaining somebody through menopause on hormones and never removing it? And yeah, could be very, very different. So again, each time they tested a slightly different question than the observational data was, but I will argue that each time it was the logical thing to test. It just turned out to be wrong. So, you know, that's the Jeffersonian ideal, right? It's the Jeffersonian ideal of, for here we're not afraid to follow the truth wherever it may lead, nor tolerate any error so long as reason is free to combat it. And if only he'd been a statistician, he would have said, so long as we're free to make another error to cancel it out. So, but we do many, many comparisons in biomedicine. Observational studies that observe many outcomes, many exposures, many alternative analyses, both in terms of the way we summarize the outcome distribution and how we adjust for covariates. We see many apparent associations. They may be type 1 errors, or they may be not a type 1 error, but just poorly understood. Those examples of where I said, you know, beta carotene as a positive thing versus beta carotene as replacing bad things. You know, two very different questions. And even in the interventional experiments, we do a lot of exploratory analyses where we modify our analysis methods, we look at multiple endpoints, and we restrict to subgroups. The problem with the multiple comparisons, the probability that A or B happens is always greater than or equal to the probability that A happens. If I ask two questions, the probability that I make a type 1 error on one of those two questions is greater than the probability that I make a type 1 error on just one question. So there's a type 1 error for each endpoint subgroup combination. In the absence of treatment effect, you would still decide a benefit exists with probability 0.025 in each such combination. The multiple endpoints and subgroups increase the chance of deciding an ineffective treatment is beneficial. But the actual inflation of the type 1 error depends on the number of comparisons you do and the correlation between those two endpoints. If I do multiple comparisons where I assess the ability of aspirin to lower your body temperature in Fahrenheit, and then I do another one where I decide to assess whether it lowers your body temperature in Celsius, well, the correlation is one. There's not really a problem with doing those two. But if I try to do it on whether aspirin cures headaches or whether aspirin prevents heart attacks, the correlation isn't quite as strong. I've got a multiple comparison issue. So type 1 error inflation, as you might consider using different endpoints or different subgroups where there might be some correlation between those, I give here a table. How many comparisons are you doing? If you're only doing one, well, it really doesn't matter what the correlation is with other endpoints. You're only doing one comparison. So I'd always have a level 0.05. But if I do two comparisons, in the worst case, when I make a mistake on the first question, I won't make a mistake on the other, and vice versa, in which case my type 1 error has increased to 10%. If they're independent, it's only up to 0.98. If they're correlated at 0.9, I haven't yet seen that on any real situation of people naming two endpoints. I mean, survival and tumor progression aren't anywhere near that correlated, but you've inflated your type 1 error from 0.05 up to 0.07 just by doing two analyses with something that's so highly correlated. By the time you're doing 5 to 10, even if you have only a 0.3 correlation, you've increased your type 1 error to 35%. So this is a huge problem. Now, even just changing your summary measures, if I'm just going to take normally distributed data, and I am going to consider 6 different ways I could have compared it, not too different from what I asked you to do on this homework. So again, do not walk away from this homework or the previous one, or for that matter, the next one, saying, oh, gee, he always says do 6 different tests, so these are the 6 ones. No, really, we try to choose one of them. For instance, if I just do a single test, the 0.05, if I do both the mean and the geometric mean and look to see whether either one of those are significant, I've increased my type 1 error up to 0.057. If I do just the mean and the Wilcoxon test that I'll be talking about in a few minutes, I increase it to 0.061. 0.066, if I consider the 3. If I throw in the median, it's up to 0.085. If I throw in 2 random places where I've dichotomized the data, analogous to looking at a survival curve and suddenly saying, they're separate here, let me test it right here. You know, I get it up to a 0.17. Okay. Now, why does it matter that this was normal data? Because in normal data, the mean and the median are fairly highly correlated. And by the time I had to cheat with my normal data so that I could really do a geometric mean, I had to put it way out, the geometric mean was pretty highly correlated. So you're seeing about what the correlation is, Carly.
So this is when you're taking one summary measure or the other?
Yeah.
If you use them in combination,
oh, if you and, that would decrease it. You said not; it has to be significant on the mean and the median, then yes, that would decrease it. But this is the idea of particularly where people will get into trouble is, I'm going to look at my data and see if it looks like the t-test would be the best test, and if so, I'll use it. And if the t-test doesn't look like it's the best test, I'll use something else. Well, sometimes that the t-test is the best test. All of these, the t-test is the best test. But sometimes it looks like one of the other tests is the best. Peter?
Beforehand, how do you pick which test? You're saying you want to pick one?
Yeah. My usual approach, unless I have a really good reason to choose something, otherwise I choose the mean. But the reasons why you choose this, the way you choose this is, number one, what summary measure is scientifically most important? And there's two things that go into scientific importance. One is, what's the current burden of proof? Science is adversarial. What do you have to prove to other people? Where are we in our current state of knowledge? If I don't even know beta carotene affects vitamin E, then I probably care less about describing its dose response. But if I already know that beta carotene affects plasma beta carotene, then trying to describe a particular dose response becomes more important. You know, so those are the sorts of things. I might be more interested in modeling the data a little bit better the more knowledge I already have. But most important, science. If you have several measures that all answer your scientific question, this is the claim I made with the FEV data set. I said, you know what, for the purpose of the question I was trying to answer, the mean, the geometric mean, the median, all of those would do all right by me. I didn't really have a preference to answer my scientific question, just describing some central tendency. So then the next thing I go to is, which is the treatment likely to affect? So I have different things. I want to lower body temperature when people have fevers. And the only thing I can think of doing is putting aspirin in the water supply. Okay. Well, the treatment is not likely to affect the population median body temperature because aspirin only affects hyperthermia. It doesn't affect normal thermia. It only affects people with fever. But if you give people who don't have a fever aspirin, it won't lower their body temperature. But if they have a fever, it will lower. So do not choose the median in this stupid experiment of putting aspirin in the city water supply, because it's not likely to affect the population median. It stands a chance at affecting the population mean because we're removing outliers. It stands an even better chance of affecting the probability of having a temperature above 38 Celsius. Summarize that, choose that. Now, if I still have multiple summary measures that are scientifically important and the treatment is likely to affect, I'll choose the one that I can do statistically most precisely. I argue that the mean wins it most often on the second criterion. It's hard to change the distribution without changing the mean. And you had to do that on homework too. Right? It was easy to change the mean with an outlier or two, or to shift the distribution. But if I told you you had to change the geometric mean, boy, did you have to put in a really large mean. And you couldn't change the mean, not with one measurement. So you have to decide, is detecting outliers a good thing, or is detecting outliers a bad thing for your scientific question? When we're at an early stage of scientific knowledge, that demonstrating a difference matters. It should be publishable. Well, it really shouldn't be, but it apparently was publishable that eating peanuts appeared to be protective against diabetes. Okay, well, I don't think there was the background for that question. But, you know, just the concept. That would be a shocking enough discovery that no one anticipated. Then let's just answer the fact that there is an association, and later worry about how it shows up. And when I don't know anything, the mean is sensitive to more different ways that a distribution can change than are some of these other summary measures. So that's how I choose it. What I truly hope is sort of the same thing that I hope when I go caving, is that somebody has been there before and I won't get lost. You know. And so if somebody has analyzed this sort of data before, I tend to use what I've seen before and try to address that. In this case, we had a certain amount of correlation between these measures. If I choose a more skewed distribution, a log normal distribution, this is a distribution where if I took the logarithm of the data, it would be normally distributed. The other way to look at it is I took normally distributed data and I exponentiated it. In this setting, the geometric mean is the optimal estimator from statistical theory. But I started off and I could do any one of these tests and I had a level 0.05 test. But because these comparisons are less correlated with each other, because the mean and the geometric mean are estimating something very different, the geometric mean and the median are estimating similar things, but with varying amounts of precision. But because of this, I get my type 1 error up to 0.19. Okay. Well, I'm going to spare you, although actually I am giving this talk to epidemiology in February, but the idea of how bad is it to increase the type 1 error fourfold. And here's the way you have to think about it. Of all the things that we ever test, how many of them turn out to be right? Very low percentage. I mean, of all the new drugs that we try at some level, the vast majority of them do not turn out to be beneficial. So the numbers that I tend to use is, imagine in our wildest dreams that at the start of phase two studies, 10% of the things that we think of trying are good. 90% are bad. Now, instead of having a level 0.05 test on the 90%, instead of just having 4.5% of the bad treatments identified, you have 20% of the 90%. You have 18% of the bad treatments identified. And of the 10% that it really worked, you know, we might be finding 80 or 90% of those. So that means that most new drugs, most new risk factors you find, if you allow your type 1 error to get up this high, most of them do not work. They are errors instead. This is the positive predictive value that a Bayesian would be looking at. So this inflation of the type 1 error is bad. We need to avoid it. That doesn't mean that we need to live and die by 0.05 at any given time, but we just need to control our type 1 error. We need to understand what we're doing. Okay, that having been said, suppose we do want to look at the median. How do we go about doing it? The scientific relevance, sometimes when it's most important to show the effect across all subjects, that I am not very happy when the economy starts looking good because that famous 1% gets even richer. You know, if I want to see when I get richer. If y'all are the 99%, I don't mind as much. It's just me, right? So I would want to see an effect there. So in sociology, the exact same data set, the exact same data set that to answer one question, what is the economic force of King County? I'd use the mean wealth, okay? But when I'm trying to get a little bit more sociologically oriented, how happy are the people in King County? I might shift to the median because that's giving me a better indication of what the typical person is doing. The statistical issues are not really why do you use the median. It's really more why do you not use the median. Well, only when you have a distribution with extremely heavy tails does the sample median tend to do better than the mean. We just aren't as good at estimating it. There are some distributions, however, that it's true. I'll just note that in many of those distributions that we estimate the sample median better than the sample mean, we estimate the sample geometric mean even better than that. There is approximate inference for the sample median. With continuous data, the sample median is normally distributed in large samples, but the formula is extremely hard to use. It is consistent. The sample mean is in large samples will be sample median. Sample median in large samples will be the population median, but its standard error depends upon 1 over 4 times the value of the density at the sample, at the true median. So this is great. If you'll tell me the median, I can figure out what the density is at that value, and then I'll know the standard error, and I'm now able to estimate the median, right? So we have this circular reasoning going on here. That makes this formula hard to use. But knowing that it's normally distributed, we can use bootstrapping. We can use a bootstrapped estimate of the standard error. So bootstrapping can be used to find sampling distributions when the formulas are too difficult, based on the presumption that the sample adequately represents the true distribution of the data. It's called bootstrapping because of...
Barron-Thompson chasm.
Pardon?
barons on Moonhouses?
Yes, and what's the phrase?
He pulled himself up by his bootstraps.
That's right. Okay, so it's the impossibility of sounding like you're going to get anywhere by doing that. I take that one sample, and I am going to use that one sample to tell you what would happen if I had lots and lots of data. But we really know why this is true. That's also true when we use the sample variance from one sample to estimate sigma squared, and then we use the known relationship of sigma squared over n. It's really the same thing as bootstrapping. It's no different. But in the bootstrapping, we don't have a simple formula like sigma squared. We just have a thing to say, if I repeatedly sample from the data that I have with replacement, then I mimic what would happen if I repeated the study. So we pretend that the sample is the population. We sample randomly and with replacement from the sample to generate pseudo-samples. Each pseudo-sample uses the same sample size. Each observation is equally likely to be sampled at each draw. We do it lots and lots of times. And recall, a sampling distribution is just the distribution of the estimates you would have gotten if you'd repeated the experiment. So we're pretending that this is good enough repetition of the experiment. So the standard error is just the standard deviation of a statistic computed from each replicated experiment. Then, if we know that the statistic is approximately normally distributed, and the truth is that while people wanted to believe that the bootstrap was just wonderful and it would solve all things, just as in medicine, when you're trying to find a new treatment and most of your guesses turn out to be wrong, statisticians are no smarter. And a lot of the guesses they make that they will sell and oversell turn out not to be that beneficial. So the bootstrap works well, but truly it works best when you have a statistic that is normally distributed asymptotically. And so we use the confidence interval by taking an estimated standard error and using theta hat plus or minus the critical value times that standard error. Again, we use the hypothesis test based on theta hat minus the hypothesized theta zero and divide the estimated standard error. So all that we're using bootstrapping here for is to estimate the standard error, and then we just do statistics as usual. So an example. What if I wanted to get the standard error of the sample median? Well, my original sample had 5 observations. Probably asymptotic results don't hold at this particular sample size, but we're going to do it anyway. So my original sample, 15837, the median was 5. That was my observation. But I don't know what the standard error would be. So I take bootstrap pseudo sample 1. In that one, I sampled 1 twice, 7 twice, 3 once, 5 and 8 not at all. These are, by the way, real random samples. I just did pull the first ones that I get. It's not that unusual that you would have gotten duplicates. In that sample, the median is 3. In the next one, where I got 2 threes, a 7, and 2 eights, the median was 7. The next one, got the same thing. The median was 7. The next one, the median was 5. Next one, the median was 1. Okay? And I just keep on doing that some large number of times. Of course, the computer does this with very little complaint. As a matter of fact, I find that the computer almost never complains about what I do, but many times I complain about what I told it to do. So the idea is we get all of those numbers, and now I would just take the standard deviation of all of those pseudo sample medians. So I did it 1,000 times. The descriptive statistics that I got from those 1,000 pseudo samples, the mean was 4.964. The standard deviation was 1.914. The median, 5, minimum, maximum, 25th, 75th percentile. Look at that minimum and maximum. With a sample size of 5, it wasn't that rare to find the same number all 5 times, right? And in fact, we know that that would just happen 1/5 raised to the 5 times 5. So we have that standard deviation of 1.914 becomes our standard error estimate. That says if you repeat this experiment over and over again, the standard error was 1.914. So now I just take 5 plus or minus 1.96 times 1.914, and I get my confidence interval for the median of 1.25 to 8.75. Not exactly the most precise confidence interval, and I can promise you with a sample size of 5, it was also not the most accurate confidence interval. So this is really a large sample result. There are some instances when bootstrapping clearly does not work. No sample of continuous data is ever adequate to bootstrap the sampling distribution of the minimum or maximum. You just can't do it. That's because in real life, if you repeated the sample, sometimes you'd get a higher minimum or maximum, and never in your bootstrapping will you get that. Methods have been put forward to try to augment your data. You put in some false data to try to get it to behave a little bit better. This is particularly important in the high dimensional data, like when you're doing statistical genetics and you're trying to estimate the mean of high dimensional data without many observations. This becomes very important because it's quite likely that the true mean of your vector is not within the space spanned by your data. That's extremely likely. Have high dimensional data. The high P, low N problem, it's called. P with lots of parameters, and N is your sample size. When that happens, you're in a lot of trouble. You can get some pretty interesting results by this augmented data approach, but the results that I've seen about this suggest that you use the t-test, and it does fine. So, behaves well. So, as a general rule, bootstrapping behaves remarkably well for measures of location and variability. But as you get into the things that are more extreme, it doesn't do as well. In Stata, how do you do inference with the median? Well, Stata does have some capability to perform inference using the sample median. Sintile does provide confidence intervals based on binomial distributions. This is adequate for the quantification of the population median. And if you sort of use those to get a standard error, you could sort of fake the idea of combining the estimates for that. There is also a function, and this I added this morning, by the way, to this slide. So it is now posted, but you might, if you printed out your result, you don't have these last parts on there. So you might want to get it. It's on the up on the website. Median performs Mood's test that compares the portion of each group that is above the combined sample's median. So basically it says, if these two populations have the same median, then it will be the same median as the combined sample by treating it as one group. So they take that median and then just look within each group how many are above or below it, and they do a chi-squared test. Wikipedia, in their article, I view Wikipedia as being 50% correct on this particular thing. They take Mood's test and say it's largely obsolete. I'd agree with that. I'm not so sure it's that good of a test. But then it says, consider the Wilcoxon rank sum instead. And as I will speak to in a few minutes, the Wilcoxon rank sum test does not test medians. So if your goal was to test the median, the Wilcoxon rank sum test does not cut it. I then did go to Wikipedia to see what it said about the Wilcoxon rank sum, and that one was correct, saying about that it wasn't testing the median. So, Stata, what I'd really like you to use on your homework is to use these bootstrap intervals, just so that I can say that you were forced to do the bootstrap once in your life. The bootstrap inference for the median bilirubin and primary bilirubinosus. There is a command, BS. There's another command, BSTRAP, that is a little bit more complicated. This is the one that's easiest for our purposes, I think. BS takes a number of commands. The first one is the analysis you're going to do with your data. In this case, I just asked it to summarize bilirubin. All I want is the median estimate. And it turns out that when I ask for the detailed summary, result 10, so underscore result and then parentheses 10, is where Stata has stored what the median is. I found this laboriously because I knew somehow or another it gave me these things with result, and I just tried different numbers until I found the one that was the median. I did not find the documentation of this to be very helpful, but the manual would have had to jump in my hands for me to find it helpful. So this, when I do 1,000 bootstrap samples, and this is overkill, this is probably more than I really need to be able to do this test, but you can do it. It then gives this output. The bootstrap statistics, where there were 418 observations, there were 1,000 replications. It tells me the bias. So the observation was 1.4. It estimated the average of all of those to be actually 0.023 less than 1.4. Some people try to do bias-adjusted bootstrap intervals and the like. I don't worry about it. This then gives you 3 confidence intervals in addition to the standard error. So the one that's labeled N is the confidence interval that just uses that standard error times the critical value 1.96 and adds it to the values. Yes?
So two questions. One is that state of commented the work for me. So is it one line like that?
It should be, and I haven't checked the most recent version to see if they've killed that. But if you do a version, you're in Stata, you can always move back to a previous version. So I will check on that to see what happens. But certainly if you move back to version 9, if you just type version 9 and type in the command, it will work.
Okay, the other thing is, so what do you usually use, or you don't usually?
I don't usually do this.
Do you use bootstrap? What? Or
do you use I don't usually test mediums.
So you usually wouldn't advise to do it?
As a general rule, I don't advise it. The geometric mean is a far better approach as a general rule. Greg?
It works. But if you copy and paste it from the homework, then you have to replace the quotes.
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, it works.
Okay, but there are bizarre characters if you do try and cut and paste for any of these things.
Could you explain what the bias means?
Well, it's trying to say that you might have an estimator that in this low sample is a biased estimator. In which case do you want to figure in that bias as you're coming up with a confidence interval? And there's a whole book on the bootstrap, and it talks about doing bias-corrected, accelerated confidence intervals and stuff like that. More for our purposes, I just want you to think about this concept of doing the bootstrapping. Sometimes we just really don't know what to do, and bootstrapping is all we can do. It works pretty well, but not as well as we first hoped. And that's really the message to walk away with this. But when I'm testing, I just rarely have a use to go after the median. But I'm just using this as an example because this is a case where we have good theory to know it's normally distributed, but we do not have a good way to estimate that standard error in a distribution-free sense without going through this bootstrap. So it behaves reasonably well. The trouble with the median truly is its standard error is large. So as this estimates a standard error, that's great, but it's just we don't estimate quantiles as precisely as we estimate the mean or the geometric mean most times. Data sets that have a distribution that we don't estimate the mean well, usually we do estimate the geometric mean well, and vice versa. And so I don't find much of a reason to go to the median. There are some sort of pathologic distributions where the median is optimal. Carly?
So if you are using the median, which confidence interval do you normally take?
Do I personally normally take? In this case, I probably would have taken the normal. I have some mild objections philosophically to the percentile one. They showed that the percentile, the way you do it, works well, but it's sort of the backwards way of what a confidence interval really should be. So my mild objections are that percentile one only works when your distribution is symmetric. But as a colleague of mine, Thomas Lumley, said, is
But if the distribution of your statistic isn't symmetric, Bootstrap doesn't work that well anyway, so you know what's the problem? So, but a lot of people, probably the percentile would be what most people would tend to use. I personally go with the normal just for that ease. Emily, do you have a question? Is there another question? Of course.
Can you pick the number of repetitions of
Well, I don't know. 1,000 seemed like a pretty good number. Some people will just say 200 is adequate. If I'm where I do use bootstrapping in my real life, well, it's not. It's my hobby. Is some of the research that we do, we're bootstrapping, and we're trying to evaluate how this whole process does. And so by the time you want to simulate 10,000 analyses, and each analysis, you need to do 1,000 bootstrap things. You don't have that much time left in your life. So we tend to take this down, and some people would say 200 ought to work. But just guess. When I'm doing it one time, I can type in 10,000 nearly as fast as I type in 100, so I do 10,000. But if I'm doing lots and lots, I do evaluate how well it seems to be behaving. So in that two-group comparison, when you had the medians and you wanted to compare across two groups, you'd get the standard error from each, and then you'd use these methods that we've talked about before, just like you have to do with the Kaplan-Meier. Okay, so it's just the same thing. We just plug in those standard errors, figure out what the standard error of the difference is. And then we come to the Wilcoxon rank sum test. I'm made fun of for my distaste for the Wilcoxon rank sum test, so just so you know. So motivation, why do we do this? Yeah, so once upon a time, computing wasn't as readily available. Finding exact distributions was difficult. Taking logarithms was difficult. I do still have a slide rule, but I can't find it right now. And people worried about the assumptions of normality. I don't think we have to worry about any of these things anymore. One idea was to downweight the influence of outliers by analyzing the ranks of the data instead of the measurements themselves. And then this is analogous to comparing the mean ranks. And I'll say that while Wikipedia was not wrong about the Wilcoxon testing the median, they did say some other things on that website that I didn't think was perfect. And this idea of whether downweighting the influence of outliers was a good thing or not is the problem. So we've talked about ranks before, as we talked about the correlation, Spearman's correlation coefficient, we also use the ranks. And basically what we do is we add up all the ranks from the groups that we're concerned with. Example in our data, we then order that data and then we put the ranks of that number. So 4 is our first observation. When we ordered our data, we found that the second, third, and fourth observation was 4. The average of 2, 3, and 4 is 3. That's the rank for the 3. When we got to 7, we found that 7 was the 6th and 7th largest number, and the average of 6 and 7 is 6.5. And that's what we'll replace 7 with, is 6.5, because that's the rank of the data. And then we compare the average ranks for the two groups. Now, it's not exactly comparing the average ranks. Actually, we're taking the sum of the ranks, and then we're finding the exact distribution from permutation tests. We just mix up all the observations. If I was doing a study and I had 10 men and 20 women, I said, you know, there's no difference in the distribution of blood pressure between men and women. Then my experiment was really just to choose 10 numbers at random. And so that's what's a permutation test. Permutation test is saying, would you have gotten this number if you just mixed up all of the numbers at random and chose them random? And this is what the Wilcoxon rank sum test does. Draws n numbers from the integers 1 to n plus n. And it's a test of the null hypothesis that two distributions are equal. This is the strong null hypothesis, we call this. It's that, I always put it, the treatment does nothing whatsoever. So you'd have exactly the same distribution. And there is a central limit theorem that can be used in large samples. So most times when we do the Wilcoxon test, we use the idea that our statistic is normally distributed. There's a Mann-Whitney formulation. In this, you're looking at the probability that a randomly chosen subject from one group might be larger than a randomly chosen subject from the other group. This is what the Wilcoxon test or the Mann-Whitney test, they're the exact same test. This is what it tests. The intuitive null hypothesis is that the probability that y is greater than x is equal to 0.5. But the Wilcoxon test is not consistent in large samples for just any difference in distributions. It's only consistent for distributions that differ in such a way the probability that y is greater than x is not 0.5. So the weak null hypothesis for the Wilcoxon test, the weak null is that the probability that y is greater than x is equal to 0.5. The strong null is that y and x have the exact same distribution. I could make those same statements about the t-test. The weak null of the t-test is it's testing that the means are equal between the two groups. The strong null is that the distribution is exactly the same in both groups. We only know the sampling distribution of our statistic under complete equality of the distributions. We can get point estimates of probability y given x. Most software does not supply it. Data does. We can't get general confidence intervals for this. So we can't get any interesting inference, if you ask me. So some books do tell you how to get confidence intervals, but they are not distribution-free confidence intervals. They usually state them as if they are the median, but under the assumptions they make, they could as well have been for the mean. So these I do not think these are appropriate confidence intervals to report because it's a very difficult assumption, and it's not distribution-free, which is why you did it. The Stata commands rank sum. You give the variable name by group bar. So it's the same syntax as you'd use for t-test, except for you say rank sum. It compares the groups, provides two-sided p-values, no relevant estimates or confidence intervals on the scientific scale. P-order does give this probability that y is greater than x, which I don't really think is a scientific measure. So comparing bilirubin by sex, this was the output. It tells you a whole bunch of stuff that isn't as important. And then down at the bottom, it tells you a p-value, 0.0518. And it does tell me that the probability that Billy for sex equals 0 is greater than Billy for sex equals 1. So the probability that bilirubin among men is greater than a randomly chosen bilirubin for a female is estimated to be 60%. I don't know what you do with that. We don't have evidence to state with 95% confidence the distribution of bilirubin is different between men and women, and I can't tell you what precision is, I can't tell you what confidence interval is, and I can't tell you anything, and so I don't know what I've learned. The other problem is that it is an intransitive test. It's possible that you prove that group A is bigger than group B, that group B is bigger than group C, and that group C is bigger than group A, with this particular measure of the probability that y is greater than x. Pretty pathologic distributions when this happens. But again, I don't like to deal with these. Okay, we'll finish up with this last part and then go on to the next lecture on Friday.